So again, just sit comfortably. So has any questions arisen during the tea break? Sometimes I do. If not, we'll press on.
Just one question about the images.
Yeah.
Because we're sort of from the West, we're used to Western images. Do you think there can be a gap, you know, in our approach to these Eastern, or you know, I'm not sure where they're from, these images.
Yeah, they're Indian or Tibetan, so yeah. I think there can be. There can be, actually. I mean, actually, this is painted by Olive, who's an old member in the movement, painted the image downstairs. And it's very westernized, actually. The difficulty is that what does Western mean anymore? You know, we can have ideas about that, who that person might be, but actually, that can be quite wrong. So really, we're trying to get to a universal image. But yes, I think at first, it can be a bit alien for some people. Certainly they were for me at first. I thought I would just explain to somebody a little bit more about our relationship to them, to this figure. So, Femi was just saying to me, where's Femi gone? Anyway, I hope you won't mind me mentioning it. But he was just saying, well, you know, what kind of relationship, it's a picture for a state of mind, isn't it? It's a picture that depicts the nature of reality. And that's true, it is a picture that depicts a state of reality, but that's not what we're trying to get at. We're trying to go much further than that. So my example was, last night I went to see Romeo and Juliet at the Globe. Not a great production, I have to say. But when you go and see Romeo and Juliet, you know full well they're actors, but what you want is that feeling of falling in love. There's lovely scenes between Romeo and Juliet where the play really suddenly comes alive. When I watched it last night, I was really struck that it's as if Shakespeare was just writing this kind of potboiler, which most of it seems to be, and suddenly, when the lovers come together, it's this completely marvellous thing that appears, as if he didn't know that that would happen. And when you go to see it, you want to be deeply moved by their drama, by the tragedy of their life, by their love, that sense of being in love when you're very young. Juliet's supposed to be 13, isn't she? You know, that sense of first love. You're wanting to be really deeply moved by that, and that's what you mean when you go to see it. And if somebody taps you on the shoulder and say, oh, they're not really dead, or don't worry, they're actors, and actually he's gay, it's really not helpful. Or actually, these are just lines that were written by this bloke ages ago, and people aren't even sure who it was. And if somebody did that, thank you, that's my cup of tea. worth having, come from the Midlands. It would be really irritating, because what you want to be is deeply moved by it, don't you? Just as you go and see a film, you want to be deeply moved by it. That's exactly the kind of relationship we're trying to get with Vajrasattva. We're not, if we just think of it as a picture that represents, it's like saying, this is an actor doing a bit of method acting. This is a good performance or a bad performance. This is da-da-da. You're trying to get away from all that, aren't you? And be completely involved in the drama. You kind of completely believe it, and at the same time you know it's been made up. Or when you read a novel, you can completely be moved by it, really inspired by it, changed by it, and at the same time you know none of this ever happened. Yeah? You know it doesn't exist in that literal sense, but you're not interested in that. What you're interested in is its impact upon your mind, upon your heart, upon your soul. Unless Vajrasattva has that impact upon your mind, your heart and your soul, it is just a picture. Yeah? Pictures are all very nice, a nice enough picture, but that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to create a relationship that has an impact on us. So we need to do something in that. So when I went to Romeo and Juliet yesterday, there were these guys behind us, and they're just chatting all the way through, they're completely bored. I mean, it wasn't a great production, but they were completely bored and weren't even trying, if you see what I mean. I mean, I don't know quite why they went. They're probably missing Xbox or whatever it was. If we do that with this image, of course it won't affect us at all. If we just think, oh yes, well it's just a picture of wisdom, it has no effect at all. You're trying to get it to deeply move you, and you need to then do something about that. But yet, at the same time, you know it doesn't literally exist. Yeah? So I thought that was a good way of thinking about it. Because we can do it, can't we? We do it in a film, we do it when we go to the pictures, we can do it in all kinds of situations in our life, and we do it naturally. We never really think, oh no, this person's died, how dreadful. We do feel that, and we know they haven't. at exactly the same time. We do it quite naturally, and all that's being asked is you do that with this figure, and that's what ritual's trying to do. You're trying to say, I'm going to throw myself on the floor to this figure, because they are so beautiful. They are so, so beautiful, and so deeply kind, they're so much everything I've always wanted. Only when you start to have that kind of relationship will the figure become the bodhisattva. Until then, it's merely a painting. Yeah? And mere paintings are nice enough, but they won't do anything spiritually. Yeah? So that's just a kind of gloss that, and it's not your question quite, but hopefully it'll give you a better thought.
Another one to mind,
okay.
Like Shakespeare would be coming from the tragedy or the comedy,
yes.
Going back to Greece.
Yeah.
This again is something that we would see, but we don't have the context to allow the lie to lead us to the truth.
Yeah.
Again.
But then, if you could just imagine, what would it be like if you saw this figure made of light sitting on a flower, this massive flower in the middle of the space? I'm not so sure it's so culturally specific. You know, angels are a little bit similar. They're figures of light, usually, you know, seen in, but you know, they're not that different. It's the same kind of impulse. And I think after a while you just get more used to it. You do need to know the Buddhist context, and that's what hopefully you'll get a grip on, and start to get a sense of on this read. So you will need to know the Buddhist context, just as you need to know that context. You need to know the love story, don't you, with the context for Romeo and Juliet. Oh, do you? I'm not sure. Anyway, let's not get into that. Anything else before I press on? So the reason I wanted that figure then, why I want to keep coming back to it, is as an antidote to thinking that shunyata, the nature of reality, is something that is an absence. It's something that isn't attractive. It's something that is a void. Yeah? Which in our Western sense easily becomes nihilistic, which has nothing to do with Buddhism. The Buddha renounced nihilism and said it was wrong, mistaken, and ugly. Interestingly, he seemed to think it was slightly worse than eternalism, which he just said was wrong, mistaken, foolish, blah, 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 but didn't include ugly. He seemed to thought that nihilism was particularly sort of bad-mannered and kind of uncouth. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So I want to explore this experience of dukkha. So we're now coming into our experience. So I said that there's this other experience, there's this other way of being, there's this other dimension, you could just call it X, there's something else, shunyata, the true nature of reality, mystery, the open dimension of being. At last, it's come back. So that's another translation of shunyata, is the open dimension of being. But now I want to come down to the other end of our experience. And our experience is this sense of dukkha. So dukkha is usually translated as unsatisfactoriness. Sometimes it's translated as suffering, but that's probably a bit misleading. There's no real clear translation for it. It's best to think of it, I think, as a sense of lack that we all feel, but we can't understand. Yeah? A sense of lack which we feel, but don't understand. It's this sense of there being something missing. It's this sense of something being absent, you know, of something not being quite right. So, from a Buddhist point of view, self itself is dukkha. The sense of ourself is inextricably linked with this sense of something missing, something not quite solid, not real, something shifting. Something dreamlike. Yeah? So traditionally there's three kinds of dukkha. There's physical and mental suffering. So there's, you know, physical pain, emotional torment, and all of its nuances and subtleties. And then there's the suffering of impermanence. There's a suffering that all things are impermanent. That everything, particularly ourselves, are impermanent. That we're merely travellers, that everything is impermanent. And especially the suffering of our lives being haunted by death. Perhaps that's the most clear expression of the suffering of impermanence, is that our lives are haunted by death. We rarely fully escape the shadow of death. It's implied right from the very beginning. It's there, born with us, is death. So recently, many of you know, a friend of mine, a friend of many of you, people come to the centre, Mohananda died very, very suddenly, having given a dinner party the night before. In fact, I was here giving a talk that evening about mindfulness, and there he was that night, he died. I got my last email from him was about when we were going to do this retreat together, and then he died. Yeah, and that's going to be, that's always possible. We know it is, we sort of know it in, we're just with the top of the heart of our head, but our lives are shadowed, kind of disturbed by, haunted by death. Even if we push that away, even if we try and distract ourselves from it, we're always vaguely conscious of that reality. So that's a suffering that we always have, even things that are beautiful. There's that deep sense that we know it's transient. Yeah. And the third sense of suffering is even more metaphysical, and that is this sense that there's nothing solid, there's nothing unconditional in our experience. There's nothing we can hold on to. There's nothing unconditional. We have this sense of self, but we have this vague prefiguration, this vague sense that it's made up, that our sense of ourself is constructed, and that there's nothing behind it, that we're figures strutting on the stage, and on our hour on the stage, and there's nothing behind it. I've been very influenced by reading this book, Money, Sex, War, Karma, very striking title, by American academic David Lloyd. It's called Notes for a Buddhist Revolution. And he really dwells on this sense of us not being real, this sense of lack, this sense of dukkha, this sense that there's something wrong. Yeah. And remember what level we're talking on. We're not talking on a something wrong in a psychological sense. We're talking something deeply wrong, deeply unsure, deeply lacking. Yeah? So, craving and hatred are to do with trying to make that feeling of lack, that feeling of unreality that we have, try to make ourselves real. They're to do with pushing things away that make us feel uncomfortable and unreal, and trying to grab things that make us feel real. Because there's not a real sense, a real self, because self is a construct, it's something that we've dreamed up, that we've created, that we've almost talked into being. Just as when you read a novel, all those people appear. I remember reading Dickens, and by the end of it, you actually feel you're going to miss all the people you've known in the novel. You really feel like you've talked to them and met them, and you can see them. And Buddha is saying that we're like that as well. And you see how sometimes the arts kind of reflect that dimly, like Shakespeare saying that we're figures strutting on a stage. So that underneath this sense of our constructed self, there's no essential, fixed, unconditioned, permanent self. There's nothing there to grasp onto. And that makes us feel really uneasy. It makes us feel that there's something really odd about us. Yeah. My sense of myself, your sense of yourself, is mainly to do with habitual ways of behaving, habitual ways of perceiving, habitual stories we tell ourselves. One of the things I'm struck by more and more is the power of stories, how deeply powerful stories are. So you only have to turn on to EastEnders for a few minutes, and before you know it, even though it's absolute right in my spirit, you still want to know what happens next, because we're so deep with stories. We want to know where they go, even if we don't think much of it. Even if we know full well where it's going to go, and there's always going to be some love affair split up and somebody gets killed, or some huge drama. Even if we know where it's going to go, we want to go there. We're sort of deep in stories. And self, as it were, is deep in stories. But we sort of know underneath that that there's nothing unconditional about us. We can't find this solid me to rely on. And it makes us feel really uneasy. Because it makes us feel tremulous. That there's something wrong with me. I think one of the things that's interesting about that is that we usually think there's something sort of wrong with me, but all of the people around me, they look really real. And they've got all these opinions, and they know about geography and history, and they can say things in public. You know, they can organise successful dinner parties. They're real, and I'm not. I have this funny inner sense of slippage, of oddness, of missingness, but they seem really real. Yeah? So you start to sort of think, oh, well, I need to be kind of more like them, because they're real. Now, how do they get to be real? They have loud voices, or they say intelligent things, or they make witty comments, or they tell me deep. You know, you try and they have lots of emotions. You try and find out, well, how do you get to be real? Because I don't quite feel real, yeah? I'm losing my notes here. So this sense of not being a real self is intrinsically uncomfortable. Yeah? It's intrinsically uncomfortable. And this is what Dukkha is saying. Because you aren't a real self in the way you think you are, you aren't a fixed, unchanging, unconditioned self from your own side, it's really uncomfortable. It makes you feel uneasy. David Loy says that he feels that the dominant mode of modern life is to feel more real. That all human beings have this deep sense of unreality about them, of dreamlikeness. I remember this particularly when I'm on retreat, particularly when I'm on a solitary retreat, where you're really trying to be mindful, you're meditating more. I really am in my best, you know, I'm awake, I'm aware, I'm in a good state. I perceive much more deeply. I go to bed at night and I think, what was that day? What happened to it? It's just like, I can't remember anything about it, it's like a dream. It's like, there's nothing about that day I can grasp. What happened today? It's all kind of slightly dreamlike. Yeah. So there's this inner sense that it's all a bit unreal, that I'm a bit unreal. So what we do is we desperately want to feel real. So, for instance, we think that the way to feel real is to have more money. Schopenhauer said that money was abstract happiness. Abstract, a very good way of thinking about it, this abstract happiness. So it's a Midas story where you just want gold. Now, gold isn't going to do you any good at all. You can't eat it, that's not good. You can't do very much with it. You can adorn yourself with it, you can have it. But it doesn't actually, it's not of no value of itself. Money has got no value in itself, as we're seeing now, as money is suddenly deeply changing its nature. There's nothing about it that we can love or kiss or touch or go out with or be congratulated by, or money's not going to fling its arms around us and whatever. It's just abstract, you know, it's an abstract happiness. And yet we can get more and more sense if we only had that stuff, we'd be more real. So if you're a rich person, you get to have big cars and big offices. I remember teaching a member of the House of Lords how to meditate. He had this huge office, it's about this size, and in the middle there was his desk. But actually he was just an ordinary human size. He had all this kind of theatre of grandeur, but he was just ordinary human size, and actually slightly sweet and insecure, I thought. I rather liked him. But the office was there to sort of create this sense of something's very big and real here. That's what money can do. This is a real person and you are nobody, you know. And that's the dynamic you're trying to create. Yeah. So money is a reality symbol. You think, you can't help but think, that the more money you have, the more real you'll feel. That's what's going to make you real. Similarly, with fame, the lure of fame, and I don't know that fame has ever been so seductive as it is now. Once upon a time, there was hardly anyone was ever famous. You know, in medieval Europe, you'd never have heard of a fake. There'd only be one famous person you know, the king and one or two of his courtiers. Yeah. But now there's famous people all over the shop, aren't there? So it seems to be possible that you could be famous. But of course, the lure of fame is that you think it will make you more real. You think it will make you a somebody at last. You'll suddenly at last feel, ah, yes, I'm solid, I'm substantial. There isn't this funny, fluttery hole in my psyche. I'm real. So if a famous person arrives, they're made much more of. If they arrive to the Wednesday class, if David Beckham came to the Wednesday class, you know, then everyone would notice, there'd be cameras, there'd be, you know, suddenly they think, well, this, he's a real person because all these people are paying attention to him, so he must be more real than me. And we have this deep yearning to be more real. So that's how to do it, is to be famous. Then we get away from this terribly uncomfortable sense of there being something missing. But of course, the extent to which we want to be famous is the extent to which we fear not being famous. We fear the anonymity of not being famous. And I wonder whether the modern urban situation has increased our... I think there must be a relationship between modern urban living and the fame culture. Because when you go into London, it's really quite mind-boggling. You don't know anyone. Millions of people on the tube streaming up. You don't know anyone. When you do meet someone, you always sort of, hello! You know, you're sort of, at last, hello! You know, it's so unusual. You talk to your friends about seeing somebody on the tube that you knew. Now, what a peculiar situation. Human beings are pack animals. Usually, you know, for most of their prehistory, they've been in very small groups, which you have known everybody intimately, possibly even too intimately. Suddenly we're in a situation where you don't know anyone. You can go out for the day, feel utterly lonely, and be surrounded by millions of people. It's a very recent historical phenomenon, starting with the poor laws and the agricultural revolution and so on, I presume. And I wonder whether that increases our sense that we need to be famous, because only then can we escape this dreadful anonymity that we experience in the city. So we try to evade in all kinds of ways this inner sense of unreality, of something missing, of some kind of lack. And we project it onto other people. We think, well, they're real, but I'm not. They're confident, but I'm not. They're successful, but I'm not. They've got a flat in Islington and I haven't, or whatever it is. And if only I had those things, I'd be like them. If only I had the kind of money David Beckham has, I'd feel definitely real then. I'd be a somebody. But of course we know it's sort of terribly, it can't possibly work because it's against the nature of reality. I mean, the other way, of course, of being more real, being more famous, is to be really bad. So there's this increasing trend of, you know, these dreadful murders and so on, shooting at schools and so on, that this kind of, at last I'll appear, at least for a bit, I'll become real in this terrible act. So we're haunted, according to Loy, and I think according to Buddhist tradition, by this sense of dukkha, that there's something really not quite right about our experience, and that's very uncomfortable. So the great thing about meditation, one of the great things about meditation, is we can turn towards that. Instead of constantly trying to make up for it, filling a vacuum that is unfillable, we can actually turn our mind to this uncomfortable sense of emptiness, in this pejorative sense, and start to move in the direction of the nature of reality. And of course we don't even always do that in meditation, do we? We very often in meditation, we're stuck at the level of ethics, because we're thinking about the past, worrying about things, and then you open your eyes at the end and somebody looks really concentrated and thinks, I don't know whether you've done that yet, you get competitive meditating, take a retreat, you open your eyes and someone's going, looking very blissful, and you always go, oh sorry, as you go out of the shrine. Dreadful thing to get into, but... So, dukkha, from a Buddhist tradition, is really, really important. Bhante says you need to cherish your dukkha. You need to really turn towards this sense of lack, this sense of something not right with me. Yeah? And I'm not talking at the psychological level, as I've said. This deep sense of existential insecurity, of a sense that we've made it up, that we're constantly making it up. I have recurring dreams about appearing in an opera. I had this dream where I was appearing in opera. I thought, I'm supposed to sing soon. In one dream, I was dressed as a whale, this huge, great big whale costume on. It's, you know, someone sort of went, okay, go, go. And I get a waddle on this day with this great big whale costume on. And I thought, I don't know this opera. I've never sung this opera before. So there's a great big crowd of people looking at me, and I've got this great big whale costume. And I went, raise water. And I managed to sing this marvellous baritone solo. And I think, I don't know what I'm singing, and I don't know what this is about. And it seemed to, I just seemed to just about be able to pull it off. I just about managed to get through this opera in a whale costume. And I think that's a metaphysical dream, that we somehow pull it off. We just about get through. Larkin used to say that he got used to going around the world acting himself. He used to just sort of act being Philip Larkin. Yeah? And in a certain sense, that's what we're all doing. So in meditation, we can turn towards that. But there is, as I say, something more. There is Vajrasattva. So dukkha is our own mind, our own self, our own delusions about ourself, and how insecure and unhoused and vulnerable that makes us, because we have this sense of unreality about ourselves. And we find that awful. Yeah? But we can actually turn towards it and move towards Vajrasattva. But you can't do that without a purified mind. You can't move towards reality. You can't move towards the nature of reality outside of this constructed self that we're constantly trying to get right. The things I think, the things I don't think, the things I like, the things I don't like. Am I a good person? Am I a bad person? That's why how it occurs to me very often. I'm a good person, not I know I'm not, I'm a bad person. Sometimes I think I'm a bad person, sometimes I think I'm a good person. Some people tell me I'm a bad person, some people tell me I'm a good person. We're constantly caught up in trying to work out who we are, once and for all. And at the same time, it's constantly breaking up, yeah? So, the only way we can apprehend beyond that is with a deep mind, yeah? So it's really important to remember that Buddhism is saying that mind has depth. I think it's missing from Western culture, that we have this idea of mind being just like a computer, that it just does lots of information. But actually, mind has depth. So you can think one thing now, and if you're in the depth of meditation, thinking that thing will have a wholly different consequence. It'll be effectively a different thing. So I was on a retreat, and we were suggesting to people that they ask themselves, what is mind? And so you could do it now, just with what is mind, and you can come up with lots of clever ideas, or you just think, oh, I don't know really, it's kind of me. But if you're in a deep meditation practice and you're very deeply absorbed, that question, what is mind, can open up a whole new dimension of reality. It's at a different level to the level of our mind now. But we forget this, that mind has depth. So the only way to apprehend reality is by cultivating this depth of mind. So let me just stop there a minute and just see if there's any questions. Said quite a lot.
I would say, I find it very, very difficult when you have these insecure feelings, or you feel a bit jittery, to actually, at that moment, feel okay. Mm. And then go on the cushion in the morning, do my meditation, do 3-minute breathing, all these things. But at the time, when you feel these insecurities or this inferiority, that person's better than you, or my mind, or working, or whatever, it's very difficult at the moment in time.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Many of you know I've been writing this book on mindfulness. And one of the things that's very much struck me than that is that you have mindfulness of chittas and you have mindfulness of dharmas. And I think that's what that's saying is that in the moment of the chitta, a chitta is your mental state. So saying you're comparing yourself with somebody. So one of the main ways we create self is by comparing ourselves. We say, oh, we're better than this person, worse than that person, the same as this person. Buddhism says that's all pride. Whether you think you're better, worse, or the same, it's all pride, yeah? So it's interesting, in our current culture of equality and so on. Buddhism says, well, it's just pride. How do you know you're the same as somebody else? So when in that moment of comparison, that's a citta. And what you're trying to do in that citta is bring to mind the Dharma, the teaching of the Dharma, the teaching that you need that connects with that. So you think, here I am creating self. And I'm doing that because I feel that I haven't got one. Well, I haven't. So let's feel this more. This is interesting. You see what I mean? But I think that this citta dharma trajectory in mindfulness is about saying that you're trying to bring the dharma into the experience as it actually happens. And that's how you gain insight. It's not that you have this idea that there's no such thing as a fixed separate self and you just think about that abstractly. You wait for that moment where you think there jolly well is this sense of self, and it's a sense of self that feels inferior, and then you bring it in. It's the meeting of your experience with the teaching that insights can occur. Yeah? So I think that's why those two come after that. You need to be really on your ball, on the ball. You need to be really vigilant. One, two, let's go for you, and then you.
Well, like, yeah, as you were speaking about that earlier, I was thinking that the same sense of the pain that comes from thinking I exist in a certain way, that the freedom or the healing comes when through the same process of actually examining that experience and seeing and looking for that anger or hatred and not finding it anywhere inside myself. And so it just seems like the pain is also the antidote to the pain, like the looking.
In a sense, again, and there's always this problem of levels. So, you know, from one level, the Buddha would say, if there's a negative emotion there, you need to change that. That's distorting your sense of reality. You won't be able to progress with that. You need to change that. You need to act. You need to find a way of being generous. You need to find a way of being patient. Whatever. And at another level, it would say, you need to see through that and realize that there's no self behind it. So it depends what level we're dealing with. And we shouldn't try and get round difficulty by abstracting it, if you see what I mean. That's one of the dangers of this teaching, is that we don't take, I want to come on to ethics in a minute, but that we don't take ethics seriously enough because we think, oh, well, it's just another manifestation of an unreal self. And there can be a value of that, but I've also seen it disastrously misapplied. So let me come back to that later. There's another question.
Yeah.
Two questions. Yeah.
I just want to say that as you were explaining all that, I've been away from sort of doing practice for a while, and it's really, really nice to know that the way you explained all that, that's exactly what I'm going through. That's,
right, yeah.
As you were talking about that, I was actually feeling it. And I just wanted to share that because for a while I've been meditating on my own without people. And really, it has completely turned my life upside down. Well, that's too dramatic, but I can no longer do the job that I was doing.
Right, right.
Because of this, it's difficult for me to explain, but
So let me just draw one or two things from what you just said. What was I going to say? So it's really important. One of the things that the Buddha is saying about Buddhist tradition is to try to move towards reality is really difficult. It's the most difficult thing you can do. So you need all the support you can get. So you really do need a context of like this with friends, people who you can share your experience with to start to explore this kind of thing. Otherwise, as Eliot says, mankind cannot stand too much reality. So again, it's a question of levels. Very often what we need to do is work at a different level where we're simply cultivating positive emotion, meditating, getting friends and so on. This is trying to say, but there's something deeply uneasy about it, isn't it? And I think it's valuable to see that. And it sounds like you do as well.
It was reassuring the way you explained it.
That's right,
excellent.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, excellent. Yeah, yeah. Because
yeah. I think without that, you think, oh, this is my personal problem. Everybody else is really real, but I'm not. and I'm constantly trying to get to be as real as other people. Yes, whereas actually we're all in the same boat.
Yeah, you actually feel that there is something wrong.
That's right, yeah.
And it's not, the more you meditate, the more... It's not, meditation's not always enjoyable. That's what I found out.
Yeah, no, it's not. But that's why you need to practice the path as well. At the moment, we're not talking about the path so much, we're talking about the goal, but we'll explore that as we go along. There's another question here.
Is it my understanding correct that is the identification of self that brings on the triggers? So, if I suppose my question really is then, is there a self, or is self itself a concept?
Yeah. You'd have to say there is and there isn't. Practically speaking, there is, isn't there? You know, you think, I'll go and have breakfast, and it actually can happen. If I think you're going to have breakfast, it may not happen. You know, practically speaking, there is a self, isn't there? It's just not a fixed, permanent, unconditioned self. And that's what we try to make ourselves into, a thing that we can finally know and hold, as it were, and it be final forever. What we're trying to do is make ourselves into a permanent, unconditioned self. But let me say a bit about ethics, because I think that answers it a bit better. So, the truth of the nature of reality can be only experienced with this mind that is completely purified, so that you're not in any kind of negative mental state, including negative mental states that are about ebullience or overexcitableness, yeah? Where you're just in this pure state of mind. Buddhism places an incredible emphasis on purity, and it means primarily ethical purity. Yeah? So, what happens is that negative states of mind pollute our mind, don't they? All you need to do is, next time you're in a bad mood, just notice what it does to your mind. You can't think clearly, you think more aggressively, you get into a battle station mind. I was reading about this in Positive Psychology, that when you're in a negative state of mind, your mind goes into search and destroy. It literally starts thinking in one way and starts thinking another. And that search and destroy mind can be useful, particularly if you're trying to search and destroy something. you isolate the problem, you try and think, what's the solution? You go into that kind of mind. The trouble with that kind of mind is it's very rigid, and it's very uncreative. It can't step back and look at the larger picture. It usually isn't very flexible, and so on. You can't gain insight with that kind of search and destroy mind. You need a mind that's incredibly open, incredibly inquisitive, incredibly positive. You need the kind of mind that is amazingly sort of suggestible. The only kind of mind I can think that's similar is the state of mind you're in when you're in a very deeply creative state of mind, where new ideas come to you, new connections arise to you, new perceptions appear that you didn't know. One of the things I do is I obsessively write poems, so something just to confess there. And sometimes when you're writing, suddenly a whole new thing appears that you had no notion that you were going to write about. All these connections appear. All this creativity suddenly arises. I wrote one just recently. I was just writing about a meditation experience. Suddenly I wrote this poem, which is all about memories of my childhood. And they were so vivid, the sound of my father digging potatoes in the garden, and how you used to knock the soil off the potatoes and then pile them up. That my mother taking the washing gown off the line, how sweet peas get in all a tangle, how there was a bathtub in the garden and it had this brown puddle and there were wet leaves, and I could see it was incredibly vivid, but I had no notion that was behind some of the things I was writing about the sentence before. So in that kind of state of mind, you're infinitely suggestible, and you can connect things with different things much, much easier, and that connection feels meaningful. So in meditation, you're ending up with that kind of very, very positive mind. It actually goes beyond that, because it's much quieter, I think, than the creative mind. So what Buddhism is saying is that to do that, you need to practice ethics. You need to find ways of not acting negatively, because that pollutes your mind and it creates a stronger and stronger sense of yourself. Negative actions, negative thoughts, negative views even, make self solid and lumpy and not able to be shaped, thick, heavy. Yeah? Positive actions, positive thoughts, genuinely skillful behaviour make self light. And you know this from your own experience. When you're in a genuinely happy state, self is light. You're not self preoccupied. You're mainly sort of aware of the things around you. You're there, but you're light. You're not occluding everything. You're not coming back to you all the time. That's what we're trying to get in. And the only way to get into that is by practicing ethics, by cultivating strengths and virtues, and by consciously trying to avoid negative action. And with that kind of mind, that can make connections, that's very, very flexible and open, then we can start to turn towards the nature of reality. Yeah. So that's why you have ethics, meditation, and wisdom. You start off by realizing that negativity is just making self harder and harder and denser and more painful. If you don't believe me, next time you get into an argument, just notice afterwards whether you feel light or heavy, painful or happy, content or discontent. It's not difficult to notice. Yeah? When you're in a positive mental state, you feel lighter. Your mind's creative, you can think things, you can have a different perspective on things, you can move your perspective. With that kind of mind, you can then meditate. In that meditative state, you can then become deeply absorbed in your experience, so that your mind is not only creative, but intensely powerful. And then with that purified and powerful mind, you can then turn it on to, so what is this self that I'm so preoccupied with? What is this me? Where is this unconditioned self underneath the constructs of me? Where is this truly existing being that I'm constantly worrying about? Where is it just now? Then you can do that with some real purchase, without falling into the near enemies of that reflection. Yeah? So you can see by that that's why you've got this path of ethics, meditation and wisdom. So, any last questions about that? We'll just sit quietly for a minute at the end. But
which is the threefold path?
That's the threefold path.
So ethics feeds meditation, meditation feeds...
That's right, yeah. So it's like the threefold path is really like a great river. You know, the river leads into a bigger river, the bigger river leads into the sea. Ethics leads to meditation, meditation leads to wisdom. Even if you're doing what we call meditation, very often what you're doing is ethics.
Is there an approach towards ethics in Buddhism? Basically, what you talked about when you said we should cherish our dukkha, rather than trying to sort of suppress your urges or desire or fight with your negative mind state.
Yeah.
What you need to do is to kind of cherish it and be more kindly towards it.
You're trying to check. Yes, you're trying to cherish it, and especially you're trying to not act out of negative mental states. And especially you're trying to act out of positive mental states. So you get an unpleasant email, and as soon as you open it, they should appear, shouldn't they, with little icons with skull and crossbones on, you know, that says, print this out and read it later, don't look at it now. It's particularly unpleasant, aren't they, unpleasant emails? They immediately make you feel defensive, you kind of tighten up. So what you do is you notice there's an unpleasant experience, and you don't answer and then press send. You wait and you create a gap by noticing the painfulness of the experience and not retaliating from that pain. When you see somebody having a difficult time, you try and help. You consciously try to cultivate the good and reduce harm. Without that, there is no Buddhist life. Sometimes people want to get away from the burden of conscience, I think. Some of my concerns about sometimes people's teaching about non-duality and so on, is that we try to get away from the burden of conscience, that we can help others or we can hurt others. If we hurt others, we've temporarily resigned from the Buddhist path. if we can help others, we're going to become happier ourselves, and we're going to actually do some good. So without ethics, there is no meditation. There's just a sort of pretend meditation. And without meditation, there's no wisdom. So the Buddha's tradition constantly says, you cannot do this without going this way. It's not the threefold path, or you could do it, or you could turn left and not bother. And there's a kind of nice car park, it's great there. There isn't another way. This is what, you can try and find another way, but you'll end up having to work with ethics. I end up having to do it. And if you're serious about the Dharma, serious about meditation, you'll have to do it. And by golly, the world needs it.
What happens if you're being persecuted and you have to sort of kill or be killed?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting with these questions because most of us aren't. Most of our experience is small things. Mm. Often people ask me, what about Hitler? You know, what would you do if you were in a room with Hitler? Is it really dead? wouldn't be a problem. But the fear is, you know, what about those extreme situations? I think there's a real issue there. Most of our issues are not at that level. Most of our issues are tiny ones, like our partner doesn't wash up and we get into a bad mood. We get a negative email and we send one back. We get grumpy because there's that the tube was late. We should concentrate on working on that level. And then perhaps we might be able to do some good at a higher level. But the Buddhist kind of approach to that is that you're trying to do the most good and the least harm. You can never really quite say what that is in any moment. So my little story with this is when I found this mouse in a tube station and it had been injured. And I, you know, I'm a nice Buddhist person, so I gathered it into my bowl and I took it out and I let it free. I probably should have killed it. I don't know, but it's just as likely that I should have killed it. Because it was, if I'm trying to do the least harm and the most good, it's possible. The trouble is I don't know what death does, but it's possible, I'm not necessarily saying it is, but it's possible that killing it would do less harm and more good. Because it would probably be set on by other creatures and could be a much, much more painful death. Is it mean? So you can never create a rule that says, always. So if I said, you couldn't create a rule like never kill mice. You see what I mean? Because perhaps in that situation it would be better. I'm not saying it would, but perhaps it would. You can never create a rule saying, always kill mice. You know, you'd have to try and think, how do you do the most good and the least harm? And you can never finally pin that down. There's no abstraction of that. Sometimes, for instance, you have to be very, very challenging of people to do the most good. I have a friend of mine recently gave me a thorough telling off. And it was what I needed, actually, in this particular instance. And sometimes that's what we need. And that does more good than a there, and tea and sympathy. Sometimes that's the last thing people need. Yeah. Sometimes it's the first thing they need, but sometimes it's the last. Okay, let's just sit quietly again to finish our evening.